Keeping the promise of nonviolent resistance alive in a nation at war. This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scher on KUOW 94.9 NPR News and Information. Streaming and podcasting, KUOW.org. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Taylor Branch concludes his three-volume history of Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement in his latest book, At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years. Taylor Branch won the Pulitzer Prize in history for Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954-63. Followed it up with Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 63-65. His new book brings us 1965-1968 and finishes the trilogy. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Steve.
A lot of work, by the way.
Almost 24 years, solid.
You said you watched your children grow up and go off to college, and your son even helped you do some of the research for this book.
Yes, he did.
And he was just a baby, or even not a baby when you started.
He wasn't born when I started, but he graduated from college last year, just as I was finishing it, and helped me right at the end.
What did he tell you about that prompted him to want to help you? Otherwise, he's your dad. You know, you're his dad, and he wants to help. But what did he talk about when working on this book? Was there something about the subject matter, about King, that struck him as well?
No, I think he just wanted to help me, and he's got his first job out of college as a researcher at the National Academy of Sciences in Washington. So doing research for me, I sent him to the Library of Congress and everything. He thought that was good. He's still trying to decide what he wants to do later on.
You conclude this book, and actually what runs through this book is this idea of Martin Luther King as a prophet. And, of course, at Canaan's Edge, you know, he's been to the mountaintop, seen the promised land, but not going into it. But that's pretty strong, a prophet of nonviolence.
Oh, absolutely. He believed that you're certainly right about the titles. All three of the titles come from Exodus, kind of paralleling the Civil Rights Movement and the Moses story, parting the waters from Egypt. And they thought they were going to get in the Promised Land, but instead they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years and, you know, built idols and made mistakes and were only guided by a pillar of fire at night. And then finally, of course, got up to Canaan's edge and were allowed to glimpse the Promised Land, but then receded before they got there. So, yes, I think King is definitely a prophetic voice. I think the movement was prophetic. But on the political and secular side, I also consider the movement kind of modern founders in the sense that they were doing what the founding fathers did, which was to confront systems of hierarchy and oppression and figure out ways of converting them into institutions of common citizenship, turning the vertical into horizontal and doing it by political and nonviolent means. And in that sense, I think people make a terrible mistake to try to pigeonhole the civil rights movement just into something for that time or something just about segregation in the South or that sort of thing. They democratized the whole country.
Do you see nonviolence alive today in America, that movement, that ideal?
I think that there are tremendous numbers of people that practice nonviolence empirically and that believe in it. But it's not in public discourse. There's no movement that's connecting it all together. There's no kind of – and I include universities and the academy in this. It's not taught in the academy as a subject close to the heart of democracy. Nobody – so far as I know, nobody's even asking whether nonviolence or violence won the Cold War. We have a pretty stunted, in my view, attenuated public debate. I mean, the view coming out of it after all these years in the civil rights movement is that we built nuclear weapons for 40 years in the Cold War and everyone expected some sort of terrible Armageddon or military victory. And instead you had dock workers' nonviolent strikes by Lech Walesa and you wound up with the Berlin Wall falling around people singing We Shall Overcome without a bullet being fired. So they hit people on the head and said nonviolence dissolved the Soviet Union in the Velvet Revolution from Prague to Poland. And yet we still tend to think of it as a military phenomenon. We tend reflexively to think that the heart of our democratic witness is military.
In that notion of nonviolence, I mean, in that notion as a movement, that's where Dr. King was, especially in these last 3 years, because he was fighting to keep that ideal alive in people that were feeling like it wasn't moving fast enough.
Well, and he became lonelier and lonelier in nonviolence. It was striking to me. I didn't really expect that in writing about the last 3 years of his life. This book is 65 to 68. It starts on Selma Bridge, literally about the most basic thing in democracy, the vote. Will black people win the right to vote? But the Vietnam War is starting almost within hours. The first Marine units land in Da Nang. Within hours of Bloody Sunday on Pettus Bridge. So the two stories run along together there. And Dr. King believes in nonviolence and says that it's at the heart both of our political and our civic faith, civic and spiritual faith, that nonviolence is the key and the key connector there. It's a foreign idea to most people, but it's a pretty simple one. It's at the heart of democracy because a vote is nothing but a piece of nonviolence. That's all a ballot is. So he saw nonviolence right at the heart, but there were a lot of people who were quite frustrated at the time by the slow pace of change. So this is about the Black Power era and his pleading with Black Power people to see that nonviolence was the potent agent of change and that Black Power was going to make a lot of noise but not much change.
Taylor Branch is written at Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 1968. Well, I want to get a little more about how he felt, how you portray how Dr. King felt, but then again come back to this idea of prophecy and its importance. But part of what was going on, he's at Selma, he makes this compromise. Well, how did he feel talking with Lyndon Johnson? And because one thing you have in this book is the transcript. So we get a sense of what Johnson was saying to other people because Johnson tape recorded so much. But how did he feel talking to Johnson leading up to this? I mean, we talked about it in the last book as well. But at this juncture here, when the war is starting and Johnson wants King's support, King wants Johnson's support.
I think the relationship between King and Johnson is a remarkable Greek tragedy that's recapturable through these telephone recordings that supplement so much the classified documents, both on Vietnam and civil rights. Their relationship was more of a collaborative partnership than I ever expected. You have literal conversations where King is saying, "We really pulled something off. I never would have been able to introduce the Voting Rights Act if you people hadn't created a citizens' movement to put pressure on me to do what I already wanted to do."
Johnson saying that
to King, and I don't know of any other examples like that. We do need a citizens' movement. Of course, Johnson couldn't say that even at the time. He didn't urge King to go to Selma. He was basically saying, "We just passed the Civil Rights Bill outlawing segregation and discrimination in employment against women, and we have our hands full trying to desegregate literally a segregated country that's segregated by race and by sex. We don't need a new bill." But then he had always said that he thought voting was at the heart of everything. And in fact, Johnson told King he wished the civil rights movement had started on voting instead of schools because it was closer to the heart of American promise. Hmm. So when King went to Selma and started doing these demonstrations, Johnson was kind of in a bind because he thought it was too soon. On the other hand, he thought it was right. And their collaboration is almost intimate, I think. And then it makes it all the more poignant when they were estranged over Vietnam with the same kind of intimacy. I think they knew how fundamental the choices were. Their conversations were few and far between. They were a lot by sign language. King was proud of the fact that he never called Johnson a warmonger. He said, "I don't believe he is a warmonger. I don't believe Johnson wants to be in this war, but he's making this a choice." Johnson, by the same token, is essentially saying he didn't want to be in Vietnam. He foresaw every criticism that an anti-war person ever made, but he did it anyway because he said the war makes chills run up my spine. It's the wrong thing to do. He's constantly trying to downplay it, but he says the American people will call me chicken if I don't do it, and they'll run me out of office.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that makes him better or worse, but it certainly makes it more of a human tragedy.
King and his advisors meet with Arthur Goldberg, who's a UN ambassador at the time, and in doing it, King brings his research to bear on how Ho Chi Minh perceived America and perceived the struggle.
Yeah, this is in September of 1965. It's very early. Most of America hadn't paid attention to the war, but King has already criticized it right from the beginning, and Johnson has called him up and basically said, please go see Arthur Goldberg. And Goldberg basically said, I'm going to settle this war, so please don't break your ties with President Johnson. And then King came out and out of the meeting at the United Nations and kind of said that he thought we ought to recognize China so that we could negotiate with China, since Goldberg had told him that King had delivered his whole history of the war based on his study of it. And Goldberg basically dithered, but as soon as King came out and said they're going to try to settle the war, the White House pounced on him, and they got Thomas Dodd, senator, to jump down his throat and say King doesn't know anything about the war. He should keep his nose out of foreign affairs. He doesn't know anything about it, and so forth. And the vehemence of that reaction, which King induced, was orchestrated by Lyndon Johnson, was essentially the break. They never regained any of their political cooperation after that, because King felt that whereas Johnson respected him as a clergyman who had to preach peace, and he didn't think Johnson was a warmonger, by the rules of politics, if you're going to be my partner, you have to accept my program, like it or not. And that's the way Richard Daley played politics in Chicago the next year. So the political alliance between King and Johnson was painfully but subtly destroyed before most of America even realized that the Vietnam War was a serious conflict.
We're talking with Taylor Branch, author of At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, the third volume of his trilogy. He won the Pulitzer Prize for the first. Mike's in Port Orchard. But Mike, did you send us an email as well?
I did.
So you were at the march in 1968.
That is correct.
The Memphis I Am a Man March.
I am. I was there.
What were you doing?
I was a college student, and I was very proud to participate.
I'm sorry, Mike. Which one?
In Memphis in 1968.
1968.
So you were there. You were at the demonstrations for the sanitation workers.
That is correct. And I witnessed, you know, the students, the people coming down the street, breaking out the windows. I witnessed, the police turning a what could have been an orderly disassembling into a riot when they shot tear gas into the crowd, and so forth. It was just quite an amazing experience. But my question, and this is something that's been on my mind since for 30 years. The night after that, the evening of that, on the news, the issue was, how can Dr. King lead a poor people's march on Washington, bringing hundreds of thousands of people there, when he can't control a small march in Memphis? And my question, you know, given the FBI's role in King's life and so on, and J. Edgar Hoover's absolute passion to discredit him, have you found any indication in your research that that march was sabotaged by FBI infiltrators to basically discredit King and the People's March?
That's a very good question. The record of the FBI in this book is pretty disgraceful criminal, I would say, in what they were doing, and they certainly exploited the march. This was the first time that violence had broken out in a march that King led. This is March 28, 1968, the one that you were present for. The FBI that very evening put out press releases on blank stationery, not traceable to the Bureau, attacking King both for being a coward, saying that he left when violence broke out, and for being the instigator of the violence. So they didn't really care about consistency. They just wanted to attack King as a fraud in any way they could. I do not, however, and King's people themselves felt that some of the local groups had anticipated and planned to make a name for themselves by instigating this violence, and that but they were inside the movement, and there were some. And some of them were police informants, but I don't think that the impetus for the whole thing came from the police or the FBI. It's a very, very complicated time. Some FBI agents are solving the very first civil rights crimes down at the bottom. At the same time, the top of the FBI is politically corrupted and carrying out its vendetta.
Mike, let me ask you one more question, but before I do, just some specifics on those terrible, disgraceful things the FBI did. When you talk about Hoover sending out orders to people to write these memos to make sure they can't be traced back to the Bureau.
Right.
This is sort of standard practice that Hoover was engaged in in Chicago as well as in Memphis?
In Chicago, in Memphis. Dr. King would go to Chicago or on the Poor People's Campaign, and the FBI would be ordered on blank stationery to volunteer housing at non-existent addresses to put out for the movement. Basically, terrible harassments and kind of surreptitious things, plus propaganda that they would send out to what they call friendly news sources. But, I mean, some of it was even more vindictive than that. King was the only American citizen for whom Hoover had a standing order that when the FBI received a threat against King's life, they were not to notify King.
Hey, Mike, are you still there?
Yes.
Can I ask you, how did it change you, going and being a part of it? I mean, you must have just decided to go, huh?
Well, I was a college student. I was kind of active at the time. I was in the Christian Brothers. We were working on Beale Street, right in the neighborhood where the march took place, running a recreation center for neighborhood kids after school. I saw the garbage men picking up our garbage on our campus and so forth. And so, I just thought it was something I wanted to be a part of. And probably one of my greatest regrets in life was the fact that the night before when King gave his "I've been to the mountaintop" speech and "I've seen the promised land," I could have been there. And for some reason, I stayed home and studied for some kind of test I had to do the next day, which I have no idea now what it was all about. I do know that some of my friends who went came back and said it was the most unbelievable experience of their life.
Mike, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
You know, you're leaving him behind now, right? You're done. 24 years. You're done with this. How do you see it resonating? Because it's both history and historical fact, and then there's this idea that still resonates out there.
Yes, I think that it's up to – I think his legacy, in some senses, there's something healthy about the pioneers dying out because even Coretta, because it now will bring home what I think is truer, that the real legacy rests with us going forward. If all – what this is about is democracy and nonviolence, there are a lot of people who believe in that and non-governmental organizations and working all around the world, but it hasn't really coalesced into a confident belief that nonviolence is at the heart of democratic promise. It's at the heart of accountability, of self-government, the kind of discipline. Nobody was more disciplined than a freedom rider, and self-governing, both in a collective and an individual sense, that nonviolence was really a model for how you spread democracy the right way.
Well, it's a really difficult and demanding chore.
And so is democracy.
At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965-68, you're going to – I notice you're going to take shorter projects now and take it easy a little bit.
I try to find something on the lessons of this period, but it's been a great blessing to be on this project for all these decades.
Taylor Branch won the Pulitzer Prize in History for his book, Parting the Waters. This is the third in his trilogy at Canaan's Edge. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Steve.